Coming up on Boston Public Radio, yet another federal official says, yes, some mistakes were made, but the marathon bombings couldn't have been prevented. Are you buying it? Have all your questions been answered? Then the Globe's Alex Bean joins us. We'll discuss his latest venture into religion with today's column suggesting there may be no hell. Then food critic Corby Kummer on the $100 meal, should you feel guilty? And a Wegmans comes to Chestnut Hill. We'll get your take on the Wegmans mystique.
And muckraker Matt Taibbi skewers our judicial system in his new book, The Great Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Why are the poor presumed guilty when big bucks buy innocence? And can the home office just become our primary office? Kara Miller joins us to talk about why work never gets done at work. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan is off till Monday. Sitting in both days is our colleague and friend, Emily Rooney.
Hi, hey, there, Jim.
Emily. Do you know that old great saying, April showers bring May showers?
Yeah,
that's
what
that, I mean, this is...
I know, and we're all jumping up and down, giddy with the idea that it's going to be 60 tomorrow. I mean,
it's like, well, it's going to be 60 today, but look at it. It's crap. In any case, I know I'm not your weather person, so I'll move on. If any of you watch Homeland, which I do, you probably are among those who think that something could have prevented the Boston Marathon bombings, that we aren't getting the whole story. But officially, that is not the case.
There was no silver bullet. There was no one single event that we uncovered that we believed would have prevented these attacks.
That's Intelligence Community Inspector General Charles McCullough. He was testifying in front of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs yesterday, adding his voice to that of other federal officials who was saying, essentially, there were some mistakes, but we did all we could. So we want to hear from you. Are you satisfied with this conclusion? Is it time to accept that there are unknown unknowns, or do you think we still aren't getting the whole story? And will we ever? Our number is 877-301-8970. You're listening to two people who clearly think, we may be the wrong ones. But what was your response to listening to this character yesterday?
It's patently absurd. How about solving the triple murder in Waltham that would have prevented the Boston Marathon bombings? What do you mean?
18 months before the marathon bombing.
No silver bullet. Of course there was a silver bullet, and that was it. That really was the proverbial silver bullet.
You know, it's also amazing about this. We've asked the governor about this, and other people have been through. I know you've asked all kinds of people as well. The amazing thing to me is if they contend, as the governor did last time he was here, maybe the time before, that based on what he knows, everything that could have been done after the Waltham murders, which allegedly we're now told by the FBI, were committed by Todashev, killed by an FBI agent in Orlando, and Tamerlan Tsarnaev, that they did all they could do to investigate. Why don't they release to us what they did so that the public can be convinced they just couldn't have captured the two guys?
They still haven't charged anyone, even if they are dead.
Well,
they haven't named anybody responsible for this. And by the way, you know, I really have to believe it was just treated as a low-level drug crime.
That's what Marjorie thinks, too, yeah.
They didn't do everything they could possibly do. If they'd put the same kind of resources into solving that triple murder, which, of course, they would never do, into finding Jahar Tsarnaev that night, they would have figured it out.
You know what's as depressing is the fact there's still so many unanswered questions. I think number one is yours, the Waltham thing. Still don't know why the assessment where the FBI agent interviewed Tamerlan Tsarnaev and some of his family didn't include questions about the trip to Russia, why the FBI on the Joint Terrorism Task Force never shared the information about their interview with the Boston police, on what happened actually with Todashev in his apartment.
Oh, we know that, Jim.
Well, yeah, we know it. And the fact that the Congress, Emily, I know I've said this 400 times in the last 3 weeks, is willing to accept a Florida state attorney's report where the FBI agent who did the shooting was not made available. All that was made available was his official report submitted into the FBI files is incomprehensible to me.
And the fact that our attorney general didn't insist that she be a part of the investigation. It was the state police from Massachusetts.
Right.
They might not have been in the room, but she could have pursued that.
And here's the worst news from a piece that Matt Visor did on this in the Boston Globe this morning. In one indication, which suggests we may never get answers, in one indication that Washington's appetite for examining the marathon bombings has faded, only one Democrat and three Republican senators attended the hearing before the Senate committee.
It's shocking.
And the room was half full, two reporters, Matt Visor, I assume, and one other, which suggests that they've either bought the line or that they don't think we're ever going to get an answer. So we want to know, have you moved on? 877-301-8970. Do you want more information? Do you think we will ever get it? And why is there not? Bill Keating has been exemplary. He's the congressperson from the South Shore. He has been relentless in pursuit of information here. And by the way, he says it's not because he wants to play a blame game. He just wants to learn things so you can prevent the next domestic terror attack a la the Tsarnaevs. But he's a lone wolf on this thing.
You got to wonder if some of this is going to potentially come out at trial, either of Jahar Tsarnaev's trial or the three kids, college-age kids, who are going to be tried in June. I got a kick out of that other Globe piece today, too, where they're talking about putting a federal agent in the visiting room when Jahar Tsarnaev meets with his family or his lawyers. They're going to put a neutral or independent federal agent. What are you talking about? What federal agent is going to be neutral in this case?
And their definition of that means that he or she is not working on this case, but obviously he or she is a part of the FBI. Let's hear a little bit before we get to your calls. Here's more of what Charles McCullough had to say.
There were some errors. There were some inaccuracies. And we've made some recommendations and drawn some conclusions to address these. But at the end of the day, there's not a smoking gun, quote unquote. There's not something, there's not a single event or a singular event or a series of events that we can say, had this happened, that most certainly would have changed the scenario here. Had this happened, that would have stopped the bombing. We didn't find anything like that.
Really? Well, to underline what you said before, he said most certainly, we can't say most certainly would have prevented. By definition, most certainly, to use his words, as you say, if Tsarnaev and Todashev were arrested for the triple murder in Waltham, wouldn't have been a marathon bombing.
Yeah.
And by the way, let me be clear here so that people don't think this is, on my part at least, an anti-cop kind of thing. If they gave us an explanation, it is very possible that there's a decent explanation. They did try hard. They did do investigation. The one thing we do know, which undercuts that notion, is several people, this has been refuted by no one, that several people after the triple murder said that Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older brother, was a close friend, if not the closest friend of Brendan Mess, who's one of the three people killed in that apartment in Waltham. Tamerlan Tsarnaev was never approached by anyone after the Waltham thing, which would suggest that it was a half-hearted attempt to solve the crime.
And, you know, I spoke to the gym owner, John
Allen. That was
one
of the great interviews.
Yeah. And he said that he
Where they all worked out, by the way. Yeah.
Including Todashev.
Yeah.
And he said that when he said, oh, hey, man, I'm sorry about Brendan Mess, Tamerlan just blew him right off, didn't want to discuss it, was dispassionate about it, and yet he had allegedly been one of his closest friends.
877-301-8970. Are we out there? And I think Marjorie is in this triumvirate of people who have some questions, but maybe we're the outliers. Bob, you're in Fall River. You are next, or first, actually, on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Emily Rooney. Hi there, Bob.
Hi there. Hey, my favorite show. What a great show.
Well, thank you.
About.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Look, I think that I'm a federal civil servant, and I would confess that to you, okay? But
confess.
I'm in my 30th year, and I want to tell you that the institution of accountability, the civil service that was a professional and fairly elite when I joined it, is gone. And that institution is under assault, and both financially and the integrity that goes with it, and to ferret out an answer and get coordination with government agencies. That was our strength at one time. But now it's under attack from every quarter. They've loosened the hiring requirements, and the old guard's retiring. And as you would expect in the turnover, in this particular environment, you're losing that institutional confidence that used to be there.
Yeah, but Bob, I don't know enough because I don't work in that infrastructure to know, you know, how legitimate your point is. But old guard, new guard, information sharing was the major criticism of the handling of what happened on 9/11. We have to have better information sharing between agencies. The biggest problem, at least that I'm aware of, other than this Waltham thing that Emily mentioned, was no information sharing between the FBI, other federal agencies, with the Boston cops. So you don't need to be old guard to understand that you got to learn lessons from the horrible past. But, Bob, thank you kindly for your phone call. We appreciate it. Let's take another one. Dan in Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Dan.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Emily.
Hey, how are you?
Jim, I just want to say one thing regarding this issue. I think whatever investigations are going to come out of it, that they're going to find the information that they need to find, and it's going to work out. Work itself out. I have confidence in that because it's a bipartisan thing. There's no one in here that doesn't want to get to the bottom of everything. And I just have one comment for Emily because I don't get to ever talk to you, Emily, but I do watch the History Channel, and I want to commend your father for his bravery. Oh. I've seen pictures of him on board B-17 yep. interviewing flyers over bombing runs in Europe, and that took a tremendous amount of courage, and I just wanted to let you know that.
They do recycle that History Channel piece quite frequently. I stumble upon it myself all the time.
Hey, Dan, thank you for the call. I wish I believed what
there's a bipartisan
search for the truth.
No. First of all, the federal government is separate. I mean, they're... It's not really a partisan body so much as it is an independent body, and it's just like they're never going to find fault with themselves.
Yeah, what has to happen here, which is not going to happen, is there's got to be some independent entity outside of government that looks at this. Virtually every report we've gotten has been from a federal committee, a congressional committee, that sort of thing.
And that Harvard, or was it an MIT study? And they approached it rather gingerly because they didn't want to be too critical, but.
Well, I mean, part of the problem, I've mentioned this a million times, too, so my apologies for those who say we've heard it from you, Jim. Charlie Savage, who's worked at the Globe, went to the New York Times, wrote a great piece about a year ago and looked at the 150 investigations the FBI had done of its own agents when there had been a shooting that either led to an injury or the death of a suspect or someone being questioned. And not surprisingly, because they're investigating themselves, 150 out of 150 times, the agent was found blameless. Now, but just statistics would suggest there's got to be one or two cases, even if they operated in good faith, where they crossed the line. And according to the FBI, their people never crossed the line.
You know, it's interesting to look back at some of these cases, like that infamous Randy Weaver case, you know, the segregationist who was living in Idaho somewhere, and they came up, they shot his wife and killed his son. And at the time, I can remember being on the side of the federal agents. Same with the David Koresh thing, you know, in Oklahoma, or Texas, I guess it was. Now I'm thinking, wait a minute. Was either one of those necessary when you really think about it?
Yeah, and my sense is we speak so much about the concern and warmth we feel towards the survivors, many of whom you've interviewed. It seems to me, at minimum, beyond the general public, it's owed to them to find out if it turns out what happened had to happen. I mean, it's so obvious to me. It's pathetic. And, you know, ordinarily in these circumstances, I don't mean to get worked into a frenzy like I do every time
exactly.
we talk about it. Why are there not more Bill Keatings here? Why are there not more truth seekers? Are they worried they shouldn't start their car themselves afterwards? This is a pretty basic law enforcement investigation thing, and we're entitled to it, we're getting nothing.
Carmen Ortiz was on my show one night and insisted that the truth will come out and we will know. I mean, and when I expressed skepticism, she got a little annoyed. I thought, well, because there's a reason to not believe that's the case.
Well, especially if there's one part of the country... This is echoing Marjorie again in absentia today, where people should have a healthy skepticism of what the FBI tells them. We're sitting in it right here, and there's virtually no skepticism. I think there is in the general public, but by elected officials from top to bottom, with one or two exceptions, they're just buying the company line. And again, this thing that the most troubling piece of Visor's piece is not just the content,
really.
Virtually no legislators, and virtually two reporters totally. At this pretty important hearing. Let's go back to
the calls.
All
right, let's take a couple more calls. How about Steve from Rhode Island? Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, Steve.
It's still going.
Hi, Steve. Sorry. Go.
I may be a little off topic here, but there's a question I had that I never heard asked, and I certainly don't have an answer. When the younger Tsarnaev brother was found in that backyard in that boat, he was apparently unarmed, and everyone was saying, well, we're supposed to, as we're hunting this guy, we're going to try to take him alive. But apparently the first thing that the police did was, you know, shoot the boat completely full of holes without any provocation. Has anyone said, if they were trying to take him alive, has anyone explained why that happened?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's another question that, you know, former Boston Police Chief Ed Davis promised more than a year ago that all the data would be put forth in some kind of a detailed report about what happened that night. and you know, there was all that self-reporting, and who knows who was telling people to fire at when, what. I don't think there was anybody who was actually in charge that night, but that's an excellent question. They assumed he was armed. There was no fire coming back from the boat. I mean, why did that happen? And they could very well have killed him.
And by the way, you know why they didn't kill him, according to virtually all reports
they
now?
Missed.
Is because well, that's true, but also the then superintendent, now commissioner of Boston Police, Evans, when he got on the scene, said, "Us hold your fire." Were it not for the fact, the younger brother would be a dead body too, and I have no idea if we're ever going to get any information out of him. But the only chance we have is by having him alive. Steve, thank you.
All right.
Much for the you know, these conversations give me a
I can see you, Jim.
Huge, no, it just it is so transparency. It seems to me is such an important part of a small D democratic government, and I have to say I'm equally obsessed with the public as I am with elected officials. If the public were rising up and saying, "We demand this, we are entitled to this, you are our representatives," they'd do it. The reason no one shows up at the hearing, the reason only two reporters are there, is because they realize we're more concerned about what part of the Indian Ocean MH370 is.
Or that it's going to be 65 tomorrow.
Or whatever, exactly, than we are as to why there are four people who are dead and hundreds injured from Boylston Street and, in one case, MIT. Let's take another one.
All right, let's go to Bill in the car.
Hello, good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm not so sure that I believe the Todashev guy when he pins it on Tsarnaev. I think people are so quick to say, that must be true. But isn't it at least possible that he's deflecting it off of himself onto his dead, guilty friend?
Possible. By the way, he's not saying, when you say deflect, he's saying he was part of it.
He admitted
he said
was
it was
there.
Todashev and Tsarnaev. But do we know for a fact that what he, let's assume he did say it. Do we know that it's true? Do
no.
we know that when he wrote the confession, there was no, we have no idea. Bill, again.
They killed him.
The agent who shot him six or seven times, the Florida state attorney, was not allowed to speak to the agent. All he could do is review a written report, which, I mean, what kind of lawyer says that's acceptable? What the Florida state attorney should have said, in my estimation, I can't issue a report because the agencies involved, including the shooter, the FBI agent, were not cooperating.
Yeah, you think about it. The NBA did a better job investigating
Sterling. That is a
they went straight to him and said, "Hey, did you say that?" And he said, "I did."
That's an excellent point, Bill. Thank you for the call. And by the way, do you not think if the Florida state attorney said to the FBI people with whom he was dealing, let me just tell you something, boys. If you don't let me talk to that guy, I'm going to go public with this, and you're going to have some real problems. So you have 24 hours. I want him in my office, or I'll fly to Washington. God, there's almost like there's this cooperative veil
cabal
of silence, which is what leads people like me, and I think you, to suggest there's probably more there.
Yep.
Let's do one more. Bill on Cape Cod, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Bill.
Thanks, Jim and Emily, and I think a lot has been said that I might have said, except that I think what we're observing is the J. Edgar Hoover oath, not that he took to the country, but first do no harm to the agency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that legacy is so powerful within the FBI. That you said it earlier, Jim, we live in Boston where one of the most corrupt offices existed for decades, and nothing was ever done about it except a post-mortem investigation, kind of a show trial up here in Boston, if you recall. I forget the senator's or the representative's name that conducted that. But the Congress, I believe, is totally and thoroughly intimidated by the FBI because, as we know, the FBI keeps dossiers on all those people. I mean, they followed Martin Luther King around for, what, 25 years?
Hmm.
Tapped his phones illegally? I used to do business decades ago with a fellow who was an agent for 10 or 15 years in the Boston area. This is back in the 50s. And he had moved on from that career because he couldn't advance the way he thought he should. Anyway, long story short, he told me stories back in the 50s that would curl your hair about illegal break-ins, illegal wiretaps. They didn't give a rat's you know what.
Hey, Bill,
any of those laws.
If I were in charge, you would be leading the independent investigation of what happened in Orlando, in Waltham, in wherever, in Cambridge. Bill, thank you for the call. Well,
Is that it?
That is really.
It's not it, Jim. You know,
no, it's
well,
not.
Listen, we're not going to let this go.
Well, the beauty of this is we feed off each other. It's like in low moments when you get the sense that nobody cares anymore. It's sort of all you have to do is call up Emily or vice versa, and we start all over again.
All right. Well, up next, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam joins us, and spoiler alert here to talk about how there may actually be no such thing as hell. Is it time for the devil to turn in his horns? That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH sustainers keep this station going strong through convenient monthly installments that renew automatically. So right now, WGBH is giving credit where credit is due.
Jim Fitzgerald,
Kim Draper,
Deborah Farwell,
Susan B. Jones,
Sandra Papson,
Ron and Linda Morse,
Elizabeth Eaton.
Thank you. To earn your own WGBH production credit, visit wgbh.org/sustainer.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Wolf Greenfield, specializing in intellectual property law, supporting the business and economic news show Marketplace, weekdays from 6 to 6:30 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH Radio. And Leahy Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LeahyHealth.org. That's LeahyHealth.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney and Jim Bratta. Here with us in Studio 3 for Open Mic is Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam, who also happens to be the author of a new book. It's called American Crucifixion. You know, Emily and I were saying, I think it was earlier this morning, even if Alex's birth name were not Beam, which it is, we'd still call him Alex Beam because his words, sort of like a roof beam, keep things elevated. Alex, it's great. That's what we were saying.
I went running to the dictionary for one of yours. I should have known this one. Because
oleaginous.
Oleaginous.
You got to know that. Yeah.
Well, I do now.
Yeah, you do.
Chelsea knew
oily.
It. Like this, I want you to know. Our lead
well,
producer
oleo,
was
it should have been a clue. It
should have been.
Yeah.
So you're finding religion. What's going on here, Alex?
I don't know. Yeah, I know.
So are you right about it anymore?
Yeah, that's a totally...
accurate thing.
That's totally fair. I took X time off. I was away for 14 or 15 months. And I don't know, I came back and I write once a week as opposed to, like, I don't have to really, like, dredge up weird crap, you know, like...
like Tenebrae, like, for example.
No, Tenebrae is, like, super important because that's religious. Yeah, I don't know. I have been writing a little bit more because it's, like, funny to me. Uh-huh. Religion is essentially kind of funny and... there's not that much of it on the op-ed page,
it seems to me.
So, and I mean, as you know, Francis just came by chance, although, you know, I'm not really writing about it. So, duly noted, I guilty as charged.
So is there a hell or not?
I mean, what about it? Forget that. Is there a heaven?
Yeah.
So your thesis this morning, Alex Beam?
Well, I cherry-picked this totally dishonestly out of a notes column by John Allen Jr., the new Globe's Father Guido Sarducci, who covers the Vatican 24/7. And he on Sunday, he does these long columns. I'm not sure anyone reads to the end, but he had this detail that I just picked up and made a whole column out of, that a leading Vatican official had sort of reopened the door, as they say in Law and Order, for the possibility of hell being empty. And I mean, it's a fairly trite column. Because, like, whether there are people in hell, or hell's half full, whether Judas is in hell, which is his point of departure, which is actually very interesting, whether there's nobody in hell, what happens to infant babies who aren't baptized? I mean, this has been discussed for well over 2,000 years. So a quick Google search gives you a pretty easy column.
One of the things I have with some of the reporting about religion is you don't dare be skeptical. And I felt this way last week with the elevation.
The dual canonization thing?
It's like, really? I mean,
well, Maureen Dowd was a little, a saint he ain't is what she wrote, because of the sex abuse crisis, but she was the outlier.
People don't dare do it because somehow it
questions what religion, but you know, a reporter's job is to be skeptical.
Well, right, but I don't. To be fair to myself, yeah, I don't think I write about religion with any sort of
poetic seriousness. No, I'm making a point in general about it.
Yeah, no, I like to write about religion because I like to treat it like everything else. Mm-hmm. I like to joke about death, actually, which is a pretty serious and concerning subject. Years ago, well, not for the three of us, admittedly. I did a column called Obituary Baseball. It's my favorite column, and it's my friend Joe Kahn's favorite column. He's actually mentioned it in it. I think I'm going to bring it back. It was a very, very
favorite column you've ever written?
I have to say,
give it to us.
It's
one
of my two favorite columns I've ever written. It came up recently. And you guys will actually have to help me. Oh, yeah. Obituary Baseball was Joe Kahn and I started noticing. It started with George Peppard. And we were wondering, why was George Peppard's picture on the front page of the Boston Globe and the New York Times when he died? Now, we consider that a homer in Obituary Baseball. You get your face and part of your obit on the front page of a major newspaper. That's a homer. Now, okay, just to help you out here. Michael Janeway, the kind of not very beloved editor of the Boston Globe, died, say, two weeks ago. Yeah, yeah. And he merited B11. B11.
Wait, an editor
which is
of
like,
the Globe
it was a big
inside
headline,
the B section?
B11, because Marquez hit the Grand Slam. Gabriel Garcia Marquez died the same day. So he got a Grand Slam in Obituary Baseball. He got his face, headline, story, beginning on one, jumping.
Yeah.
But I messaged my friend Joe because I was actually kind of concerned about the Janeway play. I never worked for Janeway. I get that he wasn't very well liked. Nonetheless, there are only four, I guess there were five, only four living editors of the Boston Globe.
There's a backstory to this whole Boston Globe thing about obituaries. You may know about it. When Kirk Scharfenberg died, I'll never forget this. It was the cover
editorial page editor, for those who don't recall.
And it said, "Our tallest tree has fallen." And it was on the front page of the Globe. And I think there was a lot of reflection about this in the aftermath, like, we're making too much of one of our... He died young of a
40s,
rare
lung
cancer. He was a great guy.
Yes.
But some Globey told me that there was a lot of reflection about that after they made too much about one of their own people.
Well, okay, I remember Kirk. I don't remember that headline, which sounds totally inappropriate, frankly, for page one or anywhere else.
That might have been the editorial, too.
That might have been the editorial.
Driscoll, I think, wrote it.
Well, the Globe, as I've kind of mentioned, the Globe is really kind of death-obsessed and very generally very good on death. Death rules at the Globe. To be totally uncharitable, when people like Kirk, who was also a friend of mine who hired me, in fact, died. What happened with the worst thing is that then every Globe columnist feels that he or she has to write this long sort of touching reminiscence.
And what's the most famous moment in Kirk's young career that everybody in journalism remembers? He was an assistant editorial page writer. He wrote an editorial about Jimmy Carter. His original draft had the headline, which he meant as a joke, not to go out, "More mush from the wimp."
I remember that.
And it made it into the newspaper. Yeah. And he survived. Yeah. And then prospered.
Good catch by both of you. But how did that come back? One might argue to bite Kirk on the rear end.
How so?
Incredible moment. Repeated 2 years ago in Pulitzer history, Kirk was voted by the jury to be a winner for the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing a few years later in his career. And that year, the horrible, despicable people who are actually on the Pulitzer Prize committee voted not to award in that category. That happened in fiction last year.
Yes,
it happened this year in
feature writing,
which is kind of nuts. But anyway, this weird karmic thing happened to Kirk that he was denied a Pulitzer Prize that had been voted him by his peers.
Do you think because of that headline?
I don't know.
No. Hey, so you were saying before that your favorite column, one of your two favorite columns, was about an obit. Both of us asked, what was the column about? And that was like 10 minutes ago.
No, he started
what
telling
was
us.
It? So what was it?
No, I did because Obituary Baseball.
Obituary
Baseball.
I brought it up to date
because
you had Janeway chased back to B11 by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Is it seen as a problem? We were just discussing Chet Curtis, our common friend and coworker. Actually, Joe Kahn wrote the obituary for him. Is that seen as a prized position in a newspaper? You say death rules of the Boston Globe. Is obituary writing, I don't mean of lesser figures, I don't mean that disparagingly, but when you get to write about the greats, is that considered a big deal or not considered a big deal?
I heard Emily kind of go, I mean, no, she's, I don't know. Well, look, let's get straight. My friend Mark Feeney spent about 5 years doing standing obits for the Globe. Mark's a Pulitzer Prize winner. He's one of the best writers at the paper. So, I mean, that's a pretty big deal, right? The New York Times writers are fairly well known. Alden Whitman certainly was. I mean, I think the answer to your question is no. But some people like that kind of work. Some people do superb work on that. You know, the woman whose name I can't bring to mind because she writes unsigned obits for The Economist is it possibly world famous. I mean, The Economist publishes one obituary a week on the back page. She's good. She's really good.
You ever written one?
Have I ever written an obit?
Yeah.
No. Funny, smart question.
Thank you.
I do them for TV. I'm an excellent obituary.
Are you really?
Oh, yeah.
What makes
sappy
an what make? Oh, it is
very, very personal.
Do you ever say unkind things? You wouldn't write an obit about
probably
someone
not
you felt poorly about.
Probably not.
Huh? You yeah would though. Clearly,
no.
Right?
I don't think I would. You know, it's the worst thing. This has probably happened to either of you, or certainly to Emily, when somebody says, I wish you would write my obit. No.
I don't want you writing mine.
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking
make
maybe
that two of us.
Yeah, you need to rethink. Okay,
hey, you
fine
know, someone whose obit I would like to write someday. Oh. You brought to our attention the most obnoxious little freshman punk I have ever read in my life. I believe his name is Tal Fortgang. Do you know who I'm talking about here?
I do. I like this guy.
Oh,
my God.
Politics.
I like this guy.
He wrote
great
this thing called Checking My Privilege. Could you explain what the concept is?
I thought it was tongue-in-cheek. I got to kick
it. I don't think it was tongue-in-cheek at all when he gets into his family's history. But start us at the beginning. What's his theory here? Why are you looking at me so weirdly, Alex?
Because I'm ready to go at it with you.
Well, go ahead. Make mine.
I wonder if you even read this.
I read the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
So what is the concept, Check Your Privilege?
Right. There's an internet meme. In fact, or there's this huge new thing out there called Check Your Privilege. And what I also sent you, of course, was a link even more funny to Harvard students demanding that privilege studies be included in their curriculum. Ha, ha, ha.
Go ahead. So tell us what Check Your Privilege means and what this kid is writing about.
Well, the whole sort of Check Your Privilege movement says that before you, man or woman, comment on something, you should check whether you have a bias that you came to a priori that you're not acknowledging. And I'll give you the one example that's all over the internet is apparently a white female TV critic said, like I could give a bleep about whether there are more people of color in Lena Dunham's horrible HBO series called Girls. And she was like deluged with tweets and people online saying, you got to check your privilege. In other words, she's a white woman, blah, blah, blah. She doesn't care whether there are men or women in color in Girls, but one should care. That's the classic check your privilege example.
And this kid here, who's a freshman at Princeton, says the reason he was offended by check your privilege because in this case they meant, hey, you're a white male. White males are the most privileged species on the planet, which they very well might be, being one. I know a little bit about it. But then he proceeds endlessly to talk about how his great-grandparents were Nazi survivors, how his grandfather came to this country, met his grandmother, started a basket-weaving company. His kid is so full of himself.
He's privileged.
He is. That's exactly
you're
the
so
conclusion
you
I
missed
reach
the whole point.
I don't think I missed it at all. What
piece
was the point I missed?
Well, because the whole privilege movement has invaded Princeton, most notably. Like, you know, hyper-intellectual Ivy League campus. And so he's reacting against that. He's saying, you're saying that me, what is he, 21, 21-year-old Jewish kid is privileged because I can't. He said, it was a big privilege for my grandfather to stand on the edge of a freaking death pit and be gunned to death.
What does that
not
have to do with him? What does that have to do with him?
His relatives.
He didn't suffer. They suffered.
Yeah, but he's being accused of being a privileged background. That's the whole thing. Yeah. And, you know,
I
don't know.
I wasn't offended by it either.
I was grossly.
Really?
I have checked my privilege and I apologize
really?
For
nothing.
Because
there's sort of a shadow debate going on here that you've got to be really careful that you talk. Because he's basically saying that minorities are saying their ancestors were slaves and that they're entitled to sort of, you know, more privilege, empathy than this guy is. And he's saying, your ancestors were slaves, my friend?
You don't know anything about me, is what he's saying. You don't know what my ancestors suffered through, right?
His ancestors come to Ellis Island with zero. I mean, I'd say you're pretty. I don't want to.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
I mean, slavery.
Check your privilege before you say this,
no,
by the way,
privilege,
my friend.
I'm so
go
off
ahead
the bleeping charts.
So finish the sentence. So praising this little obnoxious little punk.
I'm saying, you could argue that slavery is starting from like minus 100, but he's saying, I'm starting from zero. In other words, my background starts from zero. I mean, hello, I don't feel very privileged.
Speaking of my people,
he says, went to City College, just like Abe Rosenthal. It cost $8.
Okay, fine.
Okay, come on.
One of my colleagues, who obviously is on my side from the producer end of this, writes to us, checking your privilege, Alex. Isn't just about background. It's also about how society today treats a person differently based upon their race or gender, regardless of what their background was. And that's what I, you know, it's fine to say, I don't like this. Just because I'm a white guy doesn't mean that I'm not entitled to an opinion. End of discussion. But then this whole thing suggested that his suffering has been so immense that don't tell me.
I thought it was much more subtle than that, because it speaks to what you have the right to say, or even what you have the right to think. And you know, whoever wrote this about the gender thing, it's like men are allowed to say certain things, African Americans are allowed to say certain things, Jewish people can say certain things.
No, I understand.
It's like, you know, and we all think about it before we say it, for the most part, and then you're judged if you cross a line somewhere.
By the way, if he had written what you just said, I would have said, I agree with every word. Mm-hmm. It was so full of himself. I mean, he was basically saying, not only should I not check my privilege, I've had no privilege. Look where I came from. Look at my roots. Why are you sneering at me, Alex?
Well, first of all, I'm saying for the listeners, you should say the guy's name and where it appeared, and you're going to put it on your website.
Since Tal Fort Gang from Real Clear Politics.
Is that good enough for you?
Yeah, that is good enough for me.
I don't know.
I am going to keep sneering at you because I think you're, the whole notion of privilege is a notion with roots. Essentially, producer perhaps disagrees
right.
with me.
They're total and they're right.
Oh,
that's
she's
why
right. I'm wrong.
Exactly. That is the point.
Okay, call Ripley.
Okay. Yeah. I better check my privilege.
No. Alex, that's right.
Yeah.
You also sent us something which, describe this whole debate. And this is another college kind of deal. The debate is over. It also speaks to who's allowed to speak to certain issues and that sort of thing. Yes?
Yeah. 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 This is a piece by Joel Kotkin, who's like a former lefty who used to write for Inc. magazine here in Boston. You and I have talked about this because, of course, you're on the wrong side of this, too. You're all for, like, the Los Angeles Times.
They will not print letters to the editor denying climate change.
Right. Or I would argue, I mean, it's what is denying? I mean, what about maybe debating climate? I mean, there's this whole certainly an easy issue to illustrate. There's this notion that
having to post won't do it either.
Yeah.
On climate change. Is that so?
Yeah.
That there can be no more debate.
There's
no more
debate.
Right.
Well, they call it the false equivalency issue, that on the one hand and on the other hand, they're saying there is only one hand.
Yes, that's correct. And then Kotkin brings up other examples, which I'm afraid I don't have in the front of my...
Well, he's basically saying what Harvey Silverglade wrote in his book, is Shadow University thing, that essentially there is one voice that it's allowed to be heard on most campuses,
yeah. Well,
which
I mean,
are
God
liberal
bless
leaning
Harvey Silverglade. Like, yeah, no, I was with a friend of mine a couple days ago who's a conservative at the Boston Globe. He's no longer there. And his son went to Newton South, and he says, you know, his son grew up in a conservative background. And, like, to speak favorably of George W. Bush, you know, when his son was in high school, was really very uncool. And I kind of related to that, actually.
Here's an example, Alex, okay. that this guy, Kotkin, brings up. He says, a few days ago, Brendan Eich, CEO of the web browser company Mozilla, resigned under pressure from a gay rights group. Why? Because it was revealed he donated $1,000 to the campaign to pass Proposition 8, which was California's, which has since been overturned, ballot measure defining marriage as between a man and a woman.
Right. That was a huge deal
yeah.
on the internet. A lot of people came to his defense, actually. I mean, that's a complex, I mean, yeah, well, that's a religious issue. Prop 8, you know, my friends, the Mormons, of course, were instrumental in getting Prop 8 passed. I mean, that's a challenging question.
They can marry 14 women, but they can't marry.
You know what I'd like to know? I'd like to know what Tal Fort Gang thinks
about this. Okay, polygamy was outlawed in 1890, just for the record.
Okay, Alex, enough of this. Yeah. One of the reasons you're here is because of a very popular news segment that we initiated with you about 5 weeks ago. What this is if you're new to this Alex Beam thing here, Alex Beam takes a really complex topic, and in 45 seconds or less, he attempts to explain. No, he actually explains the topic. So here's the deal today. He will explain in 45 seconds or less because of what happened to us yesterday.
Did you tell him
what it was? Yeah, he knows what it is.
Yeah, I do now. Yeah,
RCN went down yesterday. There was no internet in the newsroom. We were in total panic. It was horrible.
So
he has two tasks today. He has 45 seconds, which I will time, to explain what would happen if there were a global internet collapse. And then, Alex, you get an extra 15 seconds, which is 60 in total, to explain how a global internet collapse would happen.
I want to actually address this second point rather than the first point. I'm in.
So you only have 45 seconds.
Okay, fine.
So you're going to address, let's be clear, 45 seconds to explain how a global internet collapse would happen. Is that correct?
Yes. I'm willing to do that, yes.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Can we start the timer? One, two, go.
What's interesting about the internet is that it exists below ground, not in the air or the ether generally, not via satellites, as I would have thought. And it basically exists in these really thick cables that coat fiber optic wires that go all over the world. And I have literally forgotten exactly who printed this fantastic story about 2 years ago, urging a man or woman with an axe to end all internet access. For instance, there's a cable.
15 seconds.
Okay, there's a cable that comes ashore on Long Island,
yeah.
And if you the location of these cables is secret. But if you could find that cable,
snip
you could
it.
Yeah, well, you'd need an axe. You'd really have to hack through it.
That's what happened here yesterday.
Yeah.
That is exactly what happened.
I know.
Cut.
Except cutting off internet to all of New York is a little more important than cutting off internet, you know.
To GBH.
Okay, time's
perhaps
up.
Not in your view.
Are you done or not?
No, I have one more kind of
what
bizarre.
Is it?
On this map, which you can find really, really easily on the internet, it's fascinating. There's only two ingress internet points to Australia. So think if you could find those two cables in Australia. Would they
notice?
Australia, get out of here.
That was a minute and 20 seconds.
That's cruel.
Hey,
all
before
right.
you go, how's the book doing?
Oh, thank you for asking. Tuesday, May 6th, Newtonville Books. But to answer your question, you know how I hate good news generally and good news that has... Yeah, I hate it.
However,
it's doing fine. It's doing fine. It's doing really well. And even Mormons are buying my book, thank you for asking, which happens to be called Better Living Through Yoga, which is an unusual title for a book about
I'm a big
Mormon
reader. I read Ben Bradley's book, The Ambush Murders, about 30 years ago.
Ben Bradley wrote a book called The Ambush
Murders.
Really? My book's called American Crucifixion.
We know. We're going to say what the name of the book is in a second.
You're
Alex,
kidding.
It's very nice to see you.
All right, Alex, thank you. Up
All
next,
right, thanks.
Journalist Matt Taibbi joins us for a
All
sobering
right, thanks,
look.
He goes.
Matt Taibbi, that is. Sobering look at wealth divide in America, which is creating a serious injustice within our judicial system. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
One-star review looks like slander.
One bad comment adds up to 10 good ones, and an online business can really, really suffer from what they feel are bogus bad reviews.
Lawyers arguing over online reviews. Who is seeing stars in the era of Yelp and Angie's List? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesley.edu. And SNH Construction, a general contracting firm serving the greater Boston area, specializing in residential renovations, custom building, historic restorations, renewable energy, and site work solutions. shconstruction.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy with Emily Rooney sitting in for Marjorie Egan Tomundi. In his latest book, journalist Matt Taibbi writes, "For a country founded on the idea that rights are inalienable and inherent from birth, we've developed a high tolerance for conditional rights and conditional citizenship, and the one condition, it turns out, is money." How's that for a distillation of modern-day American values? Matt Taibbi's great new book is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. He joins us in the studio. Matt, great to see you.
Good to see you.
This is a lot of work.
I read
as much as that I obviously could. I'm going to read some more this afternoon because you're coming on Greater Boston tonight, though. So you start with this basic, you lay it out. You say, look, poverty is way up, crime is way down, but the prison population has doubled, but none of the people who have cost the earth 40% of its wealth paid a dime for that. It's all just the poor people.
Yeah, no, this all grew out of, I mean, I've been covering Wall Street since the crash. I worked for Rolling Stone for ages, and all the stories I was doing were all the same. Basically, I would cover these sort of elaborate white collar capers, and nobody would ever get indicted. Nobody would go to jail, and we're still waiting for the first big case to come out of that experience. And I decided to write a book about it. But in order to do that, I kind of had to learn a little bit about how the criminal justice system works for the rest of people.
I was riveted by those stories. You have at least two characters. This guy, Tony Marone is his name, and then another guy, Andrew. I mean, you get into the nitty-gritty of these two-bit criminals.
Yeah.
With their background and the crimes they committed. And you could just see this is just the endless cycle, and they just fit the perfect stereotype of somebody who's in jail.
Yeah, no. It, what's so interesting about it is that on the white collar side, basically it's virtually impossible to get all the way to trial. I mean, there are so many obstacles for a high level prosecutor to get a case against one of those too big to fail banks.
Why?
Well, there's all kinds of things. There's the quality of the lawyering on the other side. There's the pusillanimity. They're basically afraid to go to court against these people. Mm. They come up with excuses for not doing it. They're willing to take a gigantic settlement instead of spending 10 years trying to take these companies to trial. The cases are complex. Juries don't understand them. At least that's what the prosecutors say to themselves, although I've actually been to cases where they've won convictions on very complex cases, so I don't really buy that excuse all that much, but that's what the prosecutors say.
And you're right. One of the interesting things I hold, and I think it's fair to say one should hold, if you're of your point of view, the Attorney General of the United States responsible for the failure to prosecute Wall Street for practically destroying the world, not just
right,
the United
yeah,
States.
Yeah.
But you write that it was little Eric Holder, young Eric Holder, that may have planted the seed that led to this failure to prosecute. Tell the story about him when he was a kid, I guess, comparatively speaking, working in the Clinton Justice Department, right? What's
so
the deal with that?
He was the deputy attorney general. He was like a little-known attorney in the Clinton Justice Department way back in the late 90s, and he wrote up this paper called, that's now come to be known as the Holder Memo, and It was originally sort of a get tough on crime document because it gave prosecutors all these tools they could use to take on corporate criminals. But at the bottom, there was this thing called collateral consequences, and it laid out this policy. And basically what it said was if you're a prosecutor and you're worried about going up against the big company where there may be innocent victims, if you criminally charge a firm like, I don't know, like the shareholders or executives who weren't involved in the wrongdoing, you may seek other remedies. So that might
be. Is that the philosophy? So you settle for money? I mean, you know, it's a good example.
Yeah.
You mentioned Wall Street. This Toyota thing. We had in here last week a son and a mother on the phone who they believe their daughter / sister was killed in the GM car.
Uh-huh.
And that came, this is after Mary Barra testifies pathetic testimony in front of Congress. And that comes a couple of weeks after Toyota. Toyota allegedly responsible for 5 deaths.
Right.
And there's great celebration in the Justice Department that they paid one of the biggest fines ever, which doesn't even come out of their pocket. No criminal liability. And the assumption you make is the Wall Streeters, the Toyotas, the GMs make a calculation.
The pharma companies.
Are we right? Are we willing to do unkind things and willing to pay a price that's probably going to be fairly modest cost of doing business, right? Isn't that the calculation?
I think it's actually worse when they come up with a concrete settlement, because now these companies can put a price on the wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm.
Now they can figure it into the cost of doing business. I mean, you take HSBC, right, which is one of the biggest banks in Europe, actually is the biggest bank in Europe. They get caught laundering $800 million for a couple of the world's worst drug cartels, right? I mean, this is a crime. It's not even just like coloring outside the lines, you know? And they pay a $1.9 billion settlement, but it's just like the Toyota thing. Nobody goes to jail. Nobody gets indicted. No individual has to pull money out of his or her own pocket. And so now they know this is the upper level for what they're going to have to pay, and that turns out to be 5 weeks of revenue for them. So it's not crippling. It's not a death sentence for the company. It's just a cost of doing business.
He reminded me in the book about the whole Goldman Sachs thing, not that we needed it because the crisis isn't over, but selling $11 billion worth of bad mortgages.
Mm.
I mean, and then the United States government essentially turns around and bails them out.
Well, we bailed everybody out after the crisis. I mean, the biggest way we bailed people out is in the AIG bailout, where we had all these companies that were essentially betting against the products that they themselves were selling on the market. They were buying a kind of insurance policy against their own bad mortgages. And they basically broke their bookie when AIG went out of business. AIG goes down the drain, and suddenly they're all running to the federal government saying, we need a bailout because this isn't fair. We're not going to get paid off.
Yeah, why didn't they prosecute them?
I mean, yeah, that would have been a better move. But instead, we reached into the national treasury, and we paid off all these companies that, you know, that had made these terribly irresponsible decisions instead of letting them go out of business or something. And so we made exactly the opposite decision. We elected to prop them up rather than to punish them.
Well, not just prop them up. If I may be wrong about this, but wasn't Lloyd Blankfein invited to the first state dinner of the Obama administration? I think it was the president of China. Jamie Dimon is called by Barack Obama what, the greatest CEO or the greatest financial mind. So not only do they escape prosecution, but they get carried around
privileges
in sedan chairs as if they are great leaders of this country. But people don't seem to be. I mean, the Occupy movement existed for a minute and a half, and
sure,
I don't mean to disparage them.
Sure.
But the average person, maybe because they don't make the comparison to what we'll talk to you about in a couple of minutes, real people who do get prosecuted, the little people, but they don't seem to care that much, do they?
No. I mean, look what just happened with Jamie Dimon, who you just brought up. I mean, his company last year paid $20 billion in regulatory fines, including one $13 billion settlement that included – basically covered an array of offenses that is just unheard of in the history of the financial services sector. Everything from rigging energy prices in Michigan and California to subprime mortgage fraud to, you know, there's the problem of being Bernie Madoff's banker. I mean, there's everything was in here. And not only does he not get fired, not only is he not prosecuted, he got a 74% raise at the end of the year by the board. They gave him more money to stay on. So we are enabling these people by allowing them to settle with just money, which they have plenty of. And again, prison and criminal charges are a powerful deterrent to this kind of offender. And that's exactly the kind of thing we're not using against these kinds of offenders.
You just brought up Bernie Madoff. Of course, he was an exception. And was he the exception because it was so easy to prosecute him? He largely worked alone. Maybe there was a couple of family members and assistants that were within it. I mean, the banks were in on it. I mean, they clearly had to know that something wasn't right, but...
Sure. Well, there are a couple of things here. First of all, Bernie Madoff ripped off other rich people, so that made him an anomaly. The fact that he went undetected for as long as he did is so comical in itself. This is a guy who literally did not make any trades at all for almost a decade, something like that, or more than a decade, and how the regulators could not have caught that is just incredible. And you know, basically this case landed on their doorstep. They couldn't have not prosecuted Bernie Madoff, and they gave him a ton of 100 and something years. But you contrast that with other crimes that were committed during this era that were similar, and they allowed people to settle rather than do prison time. I think that's an important contrast to make.
That's the voice of Matt Taibbi. He's written a great new book. It's called The Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Let's talk about The Divide. Emily started by mentioning that. The thing that stuck with me is this project, whatever it's called, 100%
of P100.
You can talk about that. Talk about anything at the other end of the spectrum. You can do that if you want, whatever moves you.
Yeah, P100 was crazy at the beginning of this whole thing because I didn't know a whole lot about how the criminal justice system works. I didn't know a lot about how the welfare system works, about how what happens if you're an undocumented immigrant, what kind of bureaucracy you have to go through. So I had to learn all these things and from scratch. And one of the first things I heard about was this program they have in San Diego called P100, where if you apply for welfare, the state claims the right to preemptively search your home in case you're lying on your welfare application. So essentially, you're a single mom, you apply for welfare, and you say in your application, I don't have a live-in boyfriend who's helping me with my bills. And they tell you to go sit in your home and wait, and they don't tell you when the inspector is going to come. So you might be physically sitting in that place for a week because if you miss the appointment, that you're not going to get your welfare. Then a person comes, and I heard story after story with these incredible tales where, like, an investigator would reach into a woman's underwear drawer with a pencil end, and he would pick up a pair of Victoria's Secret panties, and he would say something like, you know, who are these for? In other words, if you don't have a live-in boyfriend, why do you need these this sexy underwear? And that was an important image for me for a lot of reasons. Number one, because it not only implied it was not only just an invasion of privacy, but it also implied this sort of attitude that if a person is applying for welfare, you're not entitled to have a life
or dignity.
You know what I'm saying?
And you're guilty till proven innocent.
You're guilty.
Obviously.
Exactly. And you think about it, everybody in one way or another takes money from the government. I mean, the excuse for this program is you're taking money for the government, therefore we have a compelling interest to go into your home. But everybody takes tax deductions. Farmers take subsidies. Companies on Wall Street take bailouts. There's a huge amount of companies that take money from military-industrial spending. So how can they assert, you know, that kind of right in that instance and not in other instances? I think it's a strange thing.
Hey, Matt, how did you decide the lower crime profiles? How did you pick those guys? And you really, I mean, some of them didn't really even understand what you were doing. But
right, yeah, exactly.
How did you land on them?
So, again, I just started hanging around courtrooms and hanging around with public defenders. And also I sort of put out a couple of APBs on Twitter and through my blog on Rolling Stone and basically said I'm looking into some cases. If you hear of anything particularly strange, let me know. And so I met all these people. But the most interesting case I met was that person, Andrew Brown, mm-hmm. you mentioned,
yeah.
who I met completely by accident. He's a guy who, a 35-year-old bus driver in Bedford-Stuyvesant, an African-American man, who got arrested for obstructing pedestrian traffic. And this led me down this whole rabbit hole that I never knew existed, where people can be arrested for all these nonsense crimes, like refusal to obey a police order or obstructing pedestrian traffic, which is basically like just being black on a Tuesday night,
yeah.
which is what happened to him. He was just standing in front of his own house, and they, you know, this new way of policing that we have in cities like New York and Baltimore, it's statistics-based. They basically sweep up lots of people, and they're looking for guns and warrants and drugs. And if they don't find them, they're supposed to throw the innocent ones back, but they very frequently don't. They press forward with these nonsense cases for things like blocking traffic, and it can take a year or more to sort it out.
And they set these onerous bails that these guys could never make, and suddenly they're in prison.
Yeah, and then there's all these crazy tricks they can use to keep people to force people to plead. If you don't make bail, that's it. I mean, I was
a young legal services public defender lawyer many years
so
ago.
So you can speak to this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, bail's the whole deal, isn't it?
Of course it is.
Yeah, and
also quality of representation. And I should say to you, this is not to suggest that legal services lawyers, civil side, or public defenders are not good. The caseloads are absolutely astronomical. So even if you have the finest young lawyers, and many of them are great young lawyers, I'm not sure I was one of them, but there were a lot, and I'm serious, but there were a lot of them. When you have 50 cases and the person representing the other side has two, or at least one with a bunch of, by definition, you're not going to come out terribly well.
Absolutely, and the prosecutors know this too. I mean, that's part
of course
of,
they
that's
do.
That's part of their thinking. If you're in a U.S. attorney's office, and you're looking at, am I going to go after this bank where I'm going to have to be dealing with 20 of the best attorneys in New York City, and every move I make, I'm going to have a pile of motions on my desk the next morning that I'm going to have to fight off in order to get this thing going forward. Or I can go after 100 drug dealers and close those cases within a month. I mean, just on an unconscious level, they start drifting towards the one kind of case and away from the other kind of case. And particularly with people who are very poor and are really without means and can't make bail and are already in a position where they are desperate to make a deal because they have to get back to their kids or their job, they're going to plead in most of the cases if they don't make bail.
Well, but in fairness, I mean, both of these guys had some criminal history. I'm not talking about blocking traffic, but
robberies
and
vandalism
and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Drug dealing.
So if Eric Holder were sitting here and he said, Matt, ask me anything you want. And one of the things he said was, how can you explain somebody who, for example, now is talking about the unfair treatment of black defendants in certain cocaine convictions. Now, you want that review. Explain why the leaders of Toyota and Wall Street weren't prosecuted and why Andrew Brown and others are prosecuted. What does he say if he's has a sodium pentothal or whatever kind of thing? What's the answer? Or Barack Obama, what's the answer to that question?
I asked a lot of people who are sort of in the law enforcement system that question or questions like that. And the answer I very often got was the one thing doesn't have anything to do with the other. So they would say to me, for instance, well, the deal we made with HSBC was a good deal because now we get to monitor the company. We also get $2 billion tomorrow rather than having to wrestle with them for 10 years. And so the fact that we're throwing millions of people in jail for whatever, that has nothing to do with me. And those are state courts and we're federal. And so there's no relationship between the two. But I just reject that line of thinking totally. I think it's morally unacceptable when you create a class of people who by definition can buy their way out of a criminal offense. And you know that there are lots of people who are going to jail who have a very different set of criteria that are going to land them in jail.
It's not just morality. To me, it's not just morality, and I agree with you. There's also a practical thing. You mentioned about 10 minutes ago, Matt Taibbi, author of The Divide, a great new book. You mentioned that there's no there's no expectation of jail, so you make certain decisions. Mm-hmm. Talk about if any of these CEOs believe that this kind of behavior was going to cost them their freedom.
Oh, yeah.
Does anybody think that they'd continue to do what they... Of course they wouldn't. There's nothing more important than living the lives they live, but they know that that'll never be interrupted. So there's no incentive to do good if the alternative is to make more money doing bad.
Right, right. No, I mean, look, again, this is a class of potential offenders who are... would be strongly, let's say, influenced by the possibility of going to jail. These are not people who are not afraid of jail. They're afraid of jail. And if that was a realistic possibility, then you would see, I think, very different behavior. But we've seen very graphically since 2008 that the failure to prosecute for things like subprime mortgage fraud or robo-signing or any of these sort of varieties of fraud that went on before the crash has led pretty directly to much more serious forms of corruption. Like, you know, we now have the LIBOR scandal, which involves the biggest banks in the world essentially monkeying around with the DNA of the world economy. I mean, they're playing around with world interest rates. This affects $300 to $400 trillion worth of financial products. This is you can't imagine crimes that these are James Bond crimes that they're coming up with, and that's because they weren't prosecuted last time.
But 10 years ago, there was an aggressive. It was shocking to us, that whole Jeffrey Skilling and Ken, what's his name?
Ken Lay.
Enron Rose. Yeah. I mean, there was aggressive prosecution. Yeah. I think everybody thought that was sort of the start of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's been a progression. If you go back to the SNL crisis, we put about 800 people in jail after the SNL crisis, which was another sort of nationwide financial services fraud problem. But it paled in comparison to what happened in 2008 and the years leading up to that. But still, we put a lot of people in jail and we put a lot of people on trial after that in the aftermath of that crisis. Then we had the accounting scandals, and we brought a lot of those cases that you mentioned: Tyco, Adelphia, WorldCom, Enron, Arthur Andersen. And I think it was just the mindset of the people in the regulatory structure. They believed in the symbolic necessity of bringing these cases. I think even George Bush, on some level, recognized that the public needs to see that justice on some level is still blind a little bit. And that's what we've lost, I think, in the interim, is this idea that we have to at least keep up appearances and make a few cases.
See, I don't know if this – we're talking to Matt Taibbi, author of The Divide. My sense of this, uninformed as opposed to yours informed, is there's a decision made that I can't really take down the big boys without a huge amount of energy and time, and I might lose because they're really lawyered up, the best lawyers, the most expensive lawyers. They have tons of them. So what I'll do is I'll do what I can do. Is I'll get this, you know, the analogy that comes to mind, which may be totally inappropriate, One of the other things that put me over the edge, everything's putting me over the edge today, is when Congress had this orgy of self-congratulations when they voted to lower the interest rate back down from 6.8 to 3.8 on subsidized student loans, which, by the way, saved an average of $6 a month for the borrower. Why? Because they couldn't deal with the real problem, which is tuition is totally out of control. So right. Let's do something. Don't you think there's that sort of mentality, even if it's subliminal? We can't really do that, or we could, but it's too much work. These are easier prey, so let's go get them.
Right, but is that the mentality you want in a law enforcement official?
No, of course. So who is anybody other than you screaming about this? I mean, it's a really interesting take on inequality in this country, and a different one from who?
I mean, Elliot Spitzer, Eric Schneiderman. I mean, I think there's a lot of sort of old school prosecutors who are mortified. There are people who are still in the Justice Department who just can't believe the way things have gone in recent years, because this is not a mentality that a normal prosecutor has. I mean, there's value sometimes even in swinging and missing. When you take on a corporate offender, because you have to show the public that certain kinds of behavior aren't acceptable. We don't think this is acceptable, and we're willing to go to trial to show it. That's very different from we'll go in a back room and hammer out a deal with their lawyers, and everyone's going to walk out happy, and they're going to sleep in their own beds tonight. That's just I just can't get behind that kind of thinking.
I have to say, if Marjorie Egan was here, I always feel when she's not here, in absentia, I have to represent her. What she would say, that's exactly what her position was that she wrote in the Boston Herald when Tom Riley, the former attorney general, said, listen, I'm barred by law from prosecuting Bernie Law, Cardinal Law.
Yeah.
Her attitude was, go for it.
Yeah.
Go for it. If there's huge value in trying, and if it turns out at the end of the day you can't convict the guy, at least the public knows there was an effort made to bring some justice to this mess.
You know, on the flip side of this whole thing, I keep going to the petty crime because I'm fascinated by it. You don't have a flattering portrait of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this you know, go after them kind of mentality. There was nothing I could see that seemed to be a productive police force.
Well, and I feel bad about that.
Oh, you
because,
do?
because the only because I did talk to a number of policemen for this book who were frustrated by this new emphasis on statistics-based policing, which in cities like New York forces young officers to spend most of their time in these completely meaningless and mindless endeavors. They want to make real cases. I mean, they don't want to be just sweeping people off the street for driving a bicycle the wrong way down a sidewalk, and they don't want to be hassling innocent people either. I mean, they hate that stuff. But the problem is the current system enables the people who do like it, and it promotes those people, and those are the people who get ahead, the ones who can empty the most pads full of summonses every month. Those are the ones who advance in these stats-based policing police forces, and that's unfortunate. I think the old school cops who developed sources and confidential informants and information, and instead of just rounding up 100 people and checking them all for guns, learning through information who had a gun is a much better way of doing business. Would you agree? I mean, I
found it shocking that it was all statistics based. I mean, I can honestly say I didn't know that.
Yeah,
nor
no.
Did I.
Yeah, this is a trend that kind of began in the early 90s. It was most famous in New York with the implementation of the so-called sort of broken windows theory of policing, which is the whole idea is if people know they're going to be arrested for jumping a subway turnstile, they're not going to bring an illegal gun out in the street, because then, you know, the likelihood that they're going to end up doing real time for a trivial offense is pretty high.
That was the Rudy Giuliani time.
Giuliani, Bill Bratton, all those folks. And then there was another commissioner named Howard Saffer who came later. And you know, who knows, maybe those policies were effective on some level, but they're hugely in the neighborhoods where they're implemented the most forcefully, they arouse a tremendous amount of resentment and anger among the population, and I just don't think that's the right way to do it.
Matt, another terrific piece of work out of you.
Yeah,
Matt,
thank you
really
so much for having me.
Appreciate your time.
All
thanks
right.
for the book.
The new book is The Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. You can catch him tonight at the Harvard Bookstore and at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston. Thanks for being here, Matt.
Thank you so much.
Up next, Kara Miller joins us to talk about why we
we're
out of order.
The foodie. We're going to talk about $100 meals. We're going to talk about the opening of Wegmans and those sort of things, so don't go away.
Today at WGBHnews.org. As a little girl, the Ku Klux Klan tried to kill Sarah Collins Rudolph. Now, Sarah remembers. If you missed it on the radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
I'm Kara Miller, and every week on Innovation Hub, I talk with researchers and visionaries who are crafting our future. Join us as we look at how the world is changing on Innovation Hub, tonight at 9 on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Cambridge Savings Bank, a proud member of the community for over 175 years, providing a full range of financial products for individuals, families, and businesses. Because legacy matters, CambridgeSavingsBank.com. And the Museum of Science, where you can see over 2,000 species of sea life, introducing Journey to the South Pacific, a new IMAX film that takes you to the most diverse ecosystem on Earth. More at mos.org/South Pacific.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Emily Rooney, still sitting in for Marjorie Egan. It's a question that can be as divisive as Democrat or Republican, Mac or PC, Rolling Stones or the Beatles, and that is, of course, Wegmans or Whole Foods. If you hadn't had the opportunity to do a comparison of these two lauded supermarkets, now you can't. The wait is over, as the Globe says. A year ago, we got word that Wegmans was coming to Chestnut Hill. Now it's here, and the doors were open Sunday. Joining us to talk about its appeal and why the chain has such an ardent fan base is food writer Corby Cummer. Corby, good to see you.
Good to be here.
So, of course, the big question is, have you been there yet?
No, I have to admit, I have not been there yet. I cannot wait to be there. And here is why I've been watching that opening from the second it came up. Whenever you talk to a supplier or somebody wants to sell to a market, it's Wegmans they want to sell to. Why? Because it's family-owned and family-run. And their service is unparalleled. So the idea is that you pay fairly top dollar, but you get access to the kind of butchering and cheese cutting that Whole Foods often says it has and doesn't have.
Well, they supposedly treat their employees great. The benefits are spectacular. And when they talk a lot about how if you're a butcher, you've been flown to Argentina or wherever it is.
To see where the cows are grazing.
Right. Yeah. You go to Wisconsin or Switzerland or wherever cheese is made to see how the cheese is made. So is that a hyped kind of thing or is that a reality? They really do that kind of thing.
You know, as far as I know, that's real. And to an extent, it makes a difference in the service you get. And it reminds me of all these coffee roasters who have to tell you about hiking up the Peruvian mountain where they met the grower. They really do. Or the cheese sellers at Formaggio Kitchen in Cambridge who go to the south of France and smuggle in cheese. Of course, for their own uses. They would never sell it at Formaggio. But you get a romantic story that you don't otherwise. The idea of training service people is something that, you know, we have one of the country's leaders in training waiters, and that is Garrett Harker at Eastern Standard. And
I know Garrett, yeah.
Yeah, well, Garrett actually has seminars on service. He takes his front of the house people on field trips. So the idea of making them feel valued as well as paid makes all the difference.
How do they do it? Because they have such a range of foods. You know, somebody was saying, well, they've got the Asian section. And how do they, you know, turn it over? Isn't there a lot of waste?
There's, you know, 40% of food that's manufactured in this country is said to be wasted. So there's waste everywhere. How do they do it? Every supermarket, you know, if you go to Stop and Shop, has Asian. It has, Chinese. It's got Italian, some of every food. The question is just how ersatz is it and how essentially cookie cutter adding a little soy sauce, adding some red sauce. I have to taste through Wegmans. I remember tasting through Whole Foods once and thinking, you know, this is all fine, but really close your eyes and you could be in any cafeteria.
True.
It's just not particularly different. It's a convenience.
But the service thing is huge. I mean, you mentioned the training before. They say, I don't know if it's true either, that when you were hired, you may not speak to a customer for 4 weeks, not because they're trying to be unkind, but because they want you to know Oh, is it 40 hours? Oh, whatever it is. Okay. whatever it is. You're right. It is 40 hours because they want you to be fully up to speed on all this stuff before you you do it. And service, that is really, I mean, if you're not going to have the cheapest prices in town, even though they say they're going to beat everybody's prices, service is the key, right? Is it not?
Yeah. What I have to do is, you know, I'm smiling as you say that because I'm thinking, what a great PR campaign they've mounted. Mm-hmm. That we all, you know, believe this and we take exactly. it on faith. So the question is, what kind of local community do they serve and do they form when they've opened their doors? No matter what they say, how do they treat you when you come in? And then how many repeat customers are there?
Well, I'll answer that question. You mentioned romantic and some of the, whether it's romanticized. I told Emily this a while ago. When Marjorie and I were in our former radio life, we did an hour on Wegmans once with callers who we know their voices traditionally would only call in on the most serious political or serious issues. A woman calls in. I met my husband in the produce department. This is all true. We had our first anniversary in the prepared food section, Asian. I've never heard people talk about a product selling place with such almost orgasmic kinds of language. It really is unbelievable. The loyalty level is colossal.
So I have to say I've heard the same thing. And I've heard it from the most skeptical people imaginable. For example, Marion Nestle, the author of Food Politics, mm-hmm. who is about the most skeptical nutritionist in the entire universe. So that's why everybody relies on her because of her objectivity. She spends a lot of time at Cornell in Ithaca, where there is a Wegmans, a Whole Foods, and a local medium-priced supermarket. She's constantly doing the comparisons. She's quite impressed by Wegmans. So that's the lowest level of impressed that I've heard.
All right, I got a negative review this morning.
What was it?
On Wegmans. So a friend of mine who is, she's a personal shopper, a caterer. She does, you know, foods for, she went in there yesterday and said it was really dark. And she said, I guess all supermarkets are like this, and I didn't even think of it, that there are no windows for the most part, except for in the front right near the cashier. But she said it just felt like you were in a basement.
Some people find that lighting romantic. I want you to know, Emily, it's a matter of taste.
It's also an idea that you're spotlighting the product, and you're trying to make people not look at their future spouses in the produce aisle, but at the supermarket. And when I'm thinking of Waitrose, for example, is the high-end supermarket in London. They have quite low lighting, and it's like a boutique. Hmm. So they have pin spotlights on the shelves themselves, which are done against black. Something, by the way, that Walmart does too. They have a lot of, they use black strategically so that they highlight the product.
You know, Corby, I run, and this is true, to read your restaurant reviews, because I'm serious, because you've been there, you know, that sort of thing. How many times approximately have you seen Wegmans the musical? How many times have you seen that?
I have not.
You have not?
Seen Wegmans the musical?
Well, it just so happens we have a clip from it. Of course, it was performed at Algonquin. This is true. Algonquin Regional High School. It was in 2012 when the Northborough store opened. Here's a little piece of the classic. Wegmans.
Have to say, I am a Tony nominator. I just
you
finished.
You are?
Yes.
Well, this
so
might
I just
be in your
finished
list.
Nominating
really?
All the Tonys. Yeah.
Wow.
Listen to this. Wegmans the musical.
In cheeses, in produce, in bakers, types of
So is it too late to retroactively nominate this? That was good. There wasn't a smile on your face. That was really, really good. What'd you think?
Well, it would be nice if they'd composed original music.
Yeah, that's
well,
Jonathan
Larson's from Rent.
We know that
but
very well.
Clever.
By the way, you were this wasn't on our. You're a Tony nominee.
I am
nominator.
Oh, I'm not a nominee.
Nominator. How's that come about?
Put the fix in for Diane Paulus.
How does that come about? Because they figured that a restaurant critic knew criticism. It happens. I have a lot of theater in my background. And that I wouldn't have to drop out because most of the nominators are in the theater business and they lose a lot of them because if they get a job that has a conflict on Broadway, which they want, they drop out. And they're trying to broaden their
so
committee.
It's Wegmans one day and Broadway another. You are a man for all seasons. Hey, speaking of man for all seasons, I mentioned this to Emily. I went to a restaurant in Cambridge. I wanted to go for a long time. Went there, I think, last Friday or Saturday. Wildly overpriced. It was great. Insane.
What was it?
Priced. It's called Bondir. No, it's called Bondir. It's like 100 plus a head. And by the way, while the food was terrific, I felt incredibly guilt-ridden because I'm one who believes you shouldn't spend $100 for a meal. And then what do? I read your review of a new restaurant, of Ostra, right? And one of the things you focus on is how expensive it is. Now, first tell us how good it is, and then let's get to the whole notion of whether or not you should ever spend $100 plus for a meal in a restaurant.
Ostra is very good, and what you're paying for is the service, the atmosphere, and feeling like you're with other rich people who can afford to pay just as much as you can.
And does that, and but the food, you say something before we get to the money part of it. In your review, you said this is as fresh can be. And you didn't just mean that was a narrative that they had said. That was your reaction to how do you know? How does a layperson, you're not a layperson, how does a layperson like me know when they go to a restaurant that fish is as fresh can be? How do I know that?
Well, if there's almost no sauce and it has a very clean flavor. I was about to say strong, but there should be nothing off about it.
Not too fishy.
It should be not too fishy. Yeah. It should be sweet. It shouldn't have an odor, but it's very hard to tell in a restaurant, especially if they cloak it in a heavy sauce. But this, you could just see from the sparkling nature of the flesh, which, by the way, wasn't sparkling white. If it's sparkling white, they've often put in a bleach, which kind of hides it. So scallops, really fresh ones, are gray. They are a mother of pearl gray because they haven't been bleached, and which can give, it has sulfates in it, and that can give people headaches. So you have to sort of know things like scallops are supposed to be gray, not white. Same thing with shrimp. Shrimp, if it's either slightly pink or grayish pink or gray, really fresh, hasn't been bleached, and, you know, really good. So I could tell that that fish was absolutely fresh.
I ate there a couple months ago, too.
I hope someone else
paid. I can't remember, actually. They've redone that species. It used to be the old Avila, was that it?
Yeah.
The one that was...
It's a name that, you know, Avila. I think it's a town in Spain. Who could possibly remember that name?
Anyway, it was that... The bar area was fantastic in the old restaurant. They've more or less maintained that.
Area is fantastic at Ostra. And if you go in and have a drink, there is first-rate piano music, live piano bar. That is terrific.
You know, one of the things I like about you, Corby, is no matter what I say, you smile at me. However, there was an exception a couple of minutes ago. When I mentioned the price issue, I wouldn't say you frowned, but you looked at me in an odd sort of way. So tell me why I shouldn't feel guilty when I go in a restaurant and spend $120 per person, which I, even when I say the words now, I feel guilt-ridden. I feel a thing in my stomach. And obviously, you mentioned several times in your review, this is a really pricey place. If you have to ask how much it costs, then you can't afford it.
So it happens I've been thinking a lot about Bondir. So I was concentrating hard.
That was
a look of rapt attention.
Oh, okay, fine.
Also, I know that Cambridge recently changed from the either half course for like $14 or full course for $28 to $32. So you could have a big tasting menu with half portions, which to my mind are ample. They've gone to a $72 prefix.
Yes, they
you
have.
Can still order individually, but what I assume is that you ordered that $72 prefix.
That is true.
So that adds up with wine and a tip to more money than most people are used to spending. The reason I support it is because I think the food is so carefully prepared, and I know he's buying from all really local people.
It was fabulous, by the way. The food was absolutely fabulous. The service was fabulous. Tiny little place.
Yeah, this is worth saying at the opening. I paid a lot. I felt guilty, but it was fabulous.
It was great.
And the service was absolutely top-notch, which I think it is at Cambridge.
And it was terrific. So explain to me why I should feel okay. Occasionally, it's not a regular occurrence, maybe a couple of times a year, to go spend $100 for a meal.
Okay, in the case of Bondir, I know it's going to local people that he cares about. They don't have much money, and they can keep in business because of him. Jason Bond, the owner of Bondir, buying from them. So that's one thing. Another thing is that they put the money into the food. So you are eating something, and you're getting your money's worth as far as they've put a lot of time and thought into this. At Ostra, I'm sure they're paying top dollar for their top-notch ingredients. But I feel that what I'm paying for is service, the rent, the fittings, and the fact of exclusivity downtown. I don't feel it's entirely going to just the earnest chef-owned place that wants you to have a good time and young people who care about a future in the restaurant industry. I don't want to slight Ostra, But that's a place that's about opulence and feeling rich. Bondir is a place about caring about food and
locals.
That's true.
So I shouldn't have felt when I left, not only guilt-ridden, but I shouldn't have felt I should get a folding chair, take it to the hot bar at Whole Foods and just set up shop. But that's
absolutely not.
I love doing that, though.
But there are places, don't you agree, that I feel like it's a waste. I mean, I hate to say this because I love the legal seafood people, Roger Berkowitz and everything, but I always feel like, and I love
Roger Berkowitz.
I do too.
I love
but I once said everything is pre-prepared, and to me it tastes like it's been nuked, or everything is identical every time you get it. And you don't. That's not true in a restaurant like Oster or Bondi or something. It's different every time because it's.
I think they would call it quality control at Legal Seafoods. I don't feel it's identical because I feel it's like wood grilled or broiled or steamed, but it's the same from location to location.
Yes.
That takes a lot of work. You either like it or you don't. Yeah. But the quality is so high. I feel it's completely reliable.
Hmm.
As far as fascination and difference, that's not what you go for. You don't go for quirk at Legal. You go for reliable and fresh.
Inexpensive.
Hey, we're I am, it appears. Can we talk for a couple of minutes before you leave? Top Chef is coming to Boston. I have to say, for its, 12 seasons or something, I'm not a reality show kind of person. And I'm open-minded enough, I think, for you to convince me that food reality shows, chef reality shows, are the exception to the rule. Are they?
No.
They're horrible.
I'm not saying they're horrible. I'm just saying they're entertainment.
Yeah.
That's what reality shows are. They pit people against each mm-hmm. other, and you're supposed to be entertained by the competition. The good ones have enough information thrown in during the evaluation that you have a sense. I was on one Beat Bobby Flay.
You were a judge or something?
I was a judge.
Okay.
And it was very interesting evaluating the food with two chefs. It was two chefs plus me. One of whom, they both won competitions on TVs. Yep. And I had eaten in the restaurant of one of them, who I think recommended me to the show. We tried to say things constructive about how that food was prepared, not just, oh, it's not moist enough for me, but I think that he steamed this before he baked it and that added to the moistness. Or this cornbread was dry, and imagine if they put more milk in it or more butter in it. And you had a woman who had a soul food place in Harlem, and she was so good on fried chicken, which was made by the chef at Myers and Chang here. I didn't know that they were going to have me judging a Bostonian because they don't tell you before you go in. Mm. But I found it fun and a way of trying to talk about food in a way that's instructive, and I know that Bobby Flay tries to do that too. I don't know about other reality shows. Top Chef is much more about tension and competition. Mm-hmm. But also, Tom Colicchio knows everything there is to know about food. So if there's enough actual information thrown in. Also, the good thing is, you know, Rick Bayless, who's one of the chefs I admire most on earth, he has a Mexican restaurant, Topolo Bampo and Frontera Grill in Mexico. When he was in Chicago, it's all Mexican food. When he won Top Chef Masters, suddenly his stock went up with all the guys who probably bullied him in high school. You know, everybody, this is respect in America because it's like being on a sports competition show.
Yeah.
But what really mattered to him was the number of 10-year-old boys who came up and said, I want to be a chef because
That's pretty great.
They seem more genuine than I was watching TV last night and I stumbled upon Survivor for about 5 seconds and I realized I couldn't do it. I just saw the opening, but I said, do people still watch those things? But I know people watch the chef. Even my daughter, who's not much of a cook, is into the Top Chef.
Well, you know, I watch The Good Wife on Sunday nights.
Yeah,
I happen to like that show.
Different.
And if you tune in early, because I can never figure out what station it's on, you get the last 5 minutes. I think it's called Amazing Race or something.
Oh, that. Yes,
which
yes,
wins
yes.
Best Reality Series, a best reality thing every year at the whatever the TV thing is. It is abysmal. It is like Saturday Night Live version of what a television show should be. But I have to admit, I haven't done much on the restaurant front, so I'll give it a shot. So before you go, I want to go back to where we started for a second. When are you making your, because I've been dying to talk to you, when are you making your virgin trip to Wegmans?
I hope this weekend, which will be the first weekend I've been in town in a long time.
Yeah. That's very exciting. I'm going to be there too.
I'm going to be avoiding it.
Yeah, I'm going to start at the Asian Hot Food Bar, which I've heard very good things
about,
by the way.
I went out there, Chestnut Hill, over, I guess I was there Monday, whatever.
Oh, the day after open? Oh, I didn't even know that.
Just being on the road was a nightmare. Yeah. I didn't even go there. No, I didn't go to the store.
So part of what makes these places exciting is the idea of places where you can get food and eat it there. And Eataly was the pioneer. I wrote an endless article in The Atlantic about Eataly and the excitement of being able to eat inside a restaurant, which is taken from the European food hall model. So I will give you chapter and verse on where they got their ideas.
So wait a second. You don't think it's as much fun eating on your lap as you're driving down Route 9 after you leave the Chestnut Hill Wegmans? Now, that is a work of art.
Yeah, okay. And texting at the same time.
Exactly, yeah, with the other hand.
Putting on your mascara.
Corby, okay. It's great to see you. Thanks so much.
All right. Corby Cummer is a senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning food writer. Corby, always great to have you. All right, so we're still obsessed with Wegmans, aren't we, Jim? We're going to open up the phone lines for a few minutes. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Have you been? Do you plan to go? What's so special about Wegmans? Jim says he's going to go this weekend. He and Corby are going to text each other to meet up. Jim's going to bring his daughter. But, yeah, I'd like to have a full review next week.
877-301-8970. I have to say there are very few things like this. I mentioned when Corby was here. There are very few things that engender like this, that engender this sort of passion.
Shake Shack.
People don't like Wegmans. They love Wegmans. It's sort of, you know, you get the sense that that people were, you know, camping out, waiting on Saturday night on Route 9 to have the ability to be first there. There is something, I don't know what it is, there is this mystique about Wegmans that doesn't attach to virtually anything else. I'm a Whole Foods kind of guy, I have to admit, so it's going to be hard to rip me away. But people love this
joint. Do they sell regular food at Wegmans? I mean, one thing I always complain about, not that I drink Diet Coke, I don't, but you should be able to buy it at Whole Foods. Can you buy stuff like that?
I
if you
believe
want?
You can at
Schweppes
Wegmans.
Tonic.
I don't know what the answer is, but I am troubled by that as well. I shouldn't say troubled. I have the same concern, even though I'm not a Diet Pepsi drinker. No. I agree with you. 877-301-8970. We only have a couple of minutes here.
People are calling in, though.
But we listen, that's all you have to do is say the name
Wegmans,
and there they are. Let's take Leezy. You're on the road. You're next or first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Leezy. How are you?
Thank you very much. I've been listening with great interest because I just moved back from Greater D.C. area, and I live between two Wegmans.
Oh.
And I lived there for about 10 years. So I just, when I came back in the fall and knew that Wegmans was going to come to Chestnut Hill, I said, wow, this is great. Absolutely fantastic store. And I think listening to your piece about what makes you unique is I think you have a store that takes the function out of shopping and gives you an experience just as much as you do. Go to a Starbucks versus a Dunkin' Donuts. You go there because the people are nice, they're friendly, and it's consistent. One Wegmans is like the other, very much like what you're talking about with Legal Seafood. So just a terrific place and a wonderful atmosphere. And I didn't find that the prices of these two Wegmans were actually dramatically any more than, say, the local giant that's in that area, the Stop and Shop. And there are Whole Foods. But very, very popular, and I think it's great that Wegmans has come to Boston.
Leezy, that was an incredible
endorsement.
That was beautiful. I lived between two Wegmans. Doesn't get much better than that.
Pick his Wegman.
Leezy, thanks so much for the call. We're going to go to Attleboro, where Shannon's on the phone. Hello, Shannon. Which side are you on?
Love Wegmans. Can't get enough of Wegmans.
Why?
Well, I was first introduced to Wegmans when I went to visit some family in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And was just blown away by the quality, by the prices, by the cafe. We go camping in central Pennsylvania sometimes, and I have family on the other side of the state who don't have a Wegmans there. That's part of the camping trip is we stop.
Listen, that's exactly what I was talking about. Go ahead. We stop and what?
Oh, we stop and make sure that's part. Yeah, we get our provisions at Wegmans whenever we can. When the store opened up in Northboro, the inaugural weekend, my husband, my daughter, and I took the trip from Attleboro all the way to Northboro. And when we were there, there are people in the parking lot with RVs on the side. They had big signs that said, Wegmans or bust.
Now, have you ever thought of camping in Wegmans, Shannon, rather than on the way to camping? Consider that.
Absolutely.
I'm sure
absolutely.
You would. Hey, Shannon, that was another great one. Thank you for the call.
I don't see any negatives on this.
Well,
here.
Except if this is accurate, it appears this person has a special relationship to Wegmans. Is it Marla or is it Maria? I'm sorry. Which one is it?
It's Maria.
Maria from Worcester. Thanks so much for your call. What's your Wegmans connection?
I'm a
former Wegmans employee of Northborough.
Love that. And?
It's a wonderful place to work. Not only is it a wonderful place to shop, but I can't tell you how nice it is to work with a group of people who truly care about their employees and the customers.
What's the hourly wage?
I can't tell you that. I'm so sorry.
Hey, Marie, what's the training like we were talking about with Corby? Is it as extensive as we heard?
It is very extensive. I probably trained for about 2.5 weeks before I actually worked with customers. Additionally, the hiring process is very extensive. It took quite some time to get hired, but I'm very glad I did.
What do you do there?
I'm a cashier, part-time. Great. I'm a mom, and I work when my children are in school. They're extremely accommodating.
That's great. Hey, mm-hmm. That's a terrific call. I'm sure they'll love that one. Thank you for the call.
We do have a negative one here, Jim.
Well, it's about time. Let's see if we can fit one in.
Patricia from Rhode Island. Go,
Hi, Patricia.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Yeah, I was in the one, I guess, in Northborough in Mass 2 months ago, and I just think it was just such a, you know, typical, excessive American, you know, scene, and like we need that like a hole in the head. People need to be exercising and eating healthy, and the reason that there's no Diet Coke in Whole Foods is because they want that philosophy of healthy food in their store.
That was a far better answer than I gave, Emily.
Well, about Wegmans? Do they have junkier food there?
Do they have? If they do, they're going to have a new customer. Hey, Patricia, thank you for the call. You know, the one problem, I've only been to the one in Northborough. I haven't been to this other one yet. As you say, I'm maybe going to go with Corby on Sunday. It's really big. It's warehousey. I know it's about half the size, apparently, smaller than virtually any of those other 80 stores or something.
I don't like that.
It is really big. Yeah. And you like it's a bit too much.
Yeah, I like Whole Foods. They're really manageable.
Yeah, they are.
Everything is.
Even the big ones.
They're all laid out.
It's beautifully
the same.
Laid out. I agree. It's beautiful. In any case, that's it for Wegmans. Today.
Not for today, anyway.
I'll report back next week.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. All right, up next, Kara Miller joins us to talk about why we can't get work done at work. Rethinking the office space next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
All this month, the WGBH Spring Auction is your chance to bid on vacations, the latest electronics, fine dining experiences, rare collectibles, and even a brand new Toyota Avalon Hybrid XLE Premium, courtesy of your New England Toyota dealer. And every winning bid supports the news you trust and the programs you love. Special thanks to Rhodes Scholar, this year's premier sponsor. Place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Massachusetts College of Art and Design Summer Studios program, where high school students can experience an intensive pre-college visual arts program taught by experienced artist educators. Registering now, massart.edu. And Moo.com, where you can print business cards with the option of a different design on every card in a pack. You can say hello with Moo.com. That's Moo.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Emily Rooney is sitting in for Marjorie Egan until Monday. There's this great New Yorker cartoon where an executive-looking type is sitting in her big corner office. She's talking on the phone, and the caption reads, "We were hoping that you could work from work today." But Karen Miller is here to explain why this cartoon CEO might have it all wrong. She might actually get better results if this employee worked from elsewhere. Karen Miller, host of the Innovation Hub. It's good to see you.
Hi, good to see you, too.
I mean, is this a generational thing, Kara? Because both Jim and I, Jim actually tried it himself and it was a disaster.
Working from home.
Working
horrible.
From home.
I'll tell you the minute.
I mean, I couldn't do it. I get distracted. I had enough hard time being a mother at home.
You know, so it's interesting. I think it is a little bit of a generational thing. I mean, in fact, you see places like Facebook and Google becoming more like home at work. So you see those kinds of places have little kitchens all over the place and cappuccino machines. They feel very much like the comforts of home have come to work. And I know people at both high-tech companies and elsewhere who do a lot of working from home. Yeah, you know, I think the advantages to working from home for the next generation of people is that the technology exists that you can get so close, right? You can Skype with people. You can do GoToMeeting. You can instant chat with people. You can teleconference. You can do so many things. It is almost like being there. And the downsides of being there, which are sometimes endless meetings, people coming over to your desk and saying, hey, Emily, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you, nobody can do that at home. And so I think there is some advantage to working at home.
Yeah, let me tell you what my problem was, and and maybe this is just me. First of all, I was totally distracted, as you said a minute ago. Number two, and obviously when I did, it was like 15 years ago. Technology was at a totally different spot, maybe 20 years ago than it currently is. And secondly, I think I spent more time at the refrigerator than I did at my desk. Essentially what I did, I distracted myself. I said, I'm going to start in a few minutes. Then I went and had something to eat. I gained 25 pounds in a year, by the way, by working at home. I could never get focused. Then I read something you gave us this morning where other people have the opposite extreme. Because home is not just their home but their office, they never stop working. And so it seems to me the two extremes are more the norm, but apparently the research suggests that's not the case.
So first of all, the numbers show that we are definitely moving in the direction of working remotely more often. So you look at big companies like Aetna, Deloitte, some of these places, Intel, have like up to 80% of people working remotely some of the time.
So, to please the worker or to save money by not having to have them
I think both things are happening. But it is absolutely true what you say. People who work from home actually are a little bit heavier than people who work
at work. Is that really
true? Yeah, it's true. But I also think I would not be surprised if they're more productive. I have to say, when I work from home, I'm very often much more productive because nobody bothers me. Now, I do get a little lonely sometimes. Like, I wish somebody would come over and bother me. But it's awfully quiet. I can really get something done. And I have to say, I talked to this CEO, Jason Fried, who has – he's a CEO who has totally rethought work, and he thinks meetings, managers, they're just deadly to the amount of work you get done. And he said, you know, having people say to you all the time, hey, Jim, hey, Emily, what have you accomplished so far? It stops you from actually accomplishing what you're trying to accomplish. And people who do creative things, who write things, who design things, who create software, they need like long, uninterrupted stretches of time.
I mean, a lot of things are collaborative.
That's true.
And ideas in particular. This is a newsroom. It would be really hard to work at home. But there's nothing like really hashing out an issue, to get perspective, to hear other people's opinions. And I don't see how you can and even in the creative process, I think it would be a bit stifling if you're only reaching into your own head.
Okay, so it is true that this is a newsroom, but when you think about the work that people produce, I would argue that a lot of that work, let's say Christina Quinn or Anne Mostu goes out to report a story, a lot of the stuff that they do is at a Starbucks. They find a Starbucks where they can get Wi-Fi. They write the thing. They're all alone. Nobody's bothering them. And they turn their story. I mean, if you go to cover like the governor's press conference, you don't necessarily come back here and write your story. You send it in from the field, from where you are. So it is true that there is collaboration in terms of meetings. But I would argue that a lot of the scripts people write and everything, they put headphones on. I've had people say to me upstairs in the newsroom, I put headphones on not because I'm listening to sound, but because I want people to think I'm listening to sound. So that, you know, like a playback of a radio story or whatever, so they don't bother me.
So it's the end of human contact as we know it. I have a few more questions for you. But by the way, we'd love to hear from you. If you've tried this at-home work thing, let us know whether it's been a success or a failure. If it's been a failure in particular, why? Well, also, if it's been a success, why? The number is 877-301-8970. Have you worked at home? Let me ask you a question that I think is a variation on a theme, and if you think it's off point, tell me and we'll move on. On your great show, The Innovation Hub, if you have a choice between having a guest on an ISDN line, which to a listener means nothing, it's a line that's so crisp that makes it sound like they're right there,
exactly,
or having them sit 5 feet away from you, which would you prefer, the human contact or the same voice, the same guest, the same brains, the same whatever, in some remote location on a clear line?
I think I'd rather have them here, but that's just because it is fun to have people here. I don't think that the interview is necessarily any better when they're far away. I mean, but I also do. I also do like 80-90% of my interviews when the people are far away, because if you're interviewing people in Silicon Valley, you can't necessarily get them here. I don't know. Technology, it makes it so that you can get pretty close. I have to say, none other than Richard Branson, the entrepreneur Richard Branson, has said, we're going to look back and think it was crazy that we ever worked in offices cubicles where people, you know, we had these sort of weird cloth things separating people from other people.
Does people have a tremendous amount of downtime? I mean, I'm just making a blanket statement. There's no
In offices.
And they waste a lot of time.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is that, you know, we have this idea that people should be in offices from 9 to 5 or whatever the hours are in your office, and that just being there, physically being there, means something. In some ways, it means nothing at all, which is why I believe it's Netflix has an unlimited vacation policy, because they say, look, we don't follow you around every hour of your day.
Just get the work done.
Right, so why would we follow you around every day, right? Why would we worry if you take 3 weeks of vacation? What matters, exactly as Jim says, is do you produce? And if you can produce, and if you're faster than everybody else, good luck to you.
Now, before we get to the calls, and the lines lit up in about one nanosecond, I should say, there's an unhealthy thing, it seems to me, that the diminution in human contact has had lots of negative consequences in pretty serious ways. And I'm not equating this to these loners who lock themselves in their rooms and then do horrible things, but I guess I sort of am. When you don't have human contact except through a screen except through a line, that's who I was thinking about, actually. I mean, isn't there that potential that the isolation can have really serious consequences for our social relationships, our mental health, whatever?
So like I said, I talked to Jason Fried, who is the CEO of this company, this software company, Basecamp. And I actually basically put that question to him, you know, doesn't it get awfully lonely? And he said, well, just because you're working remotely doesn't mean you have to work at home. You can work at Starbucks. Yeah. There is a huge explosion in co-working spaces now where you can like rent a desk by the hour or by the day. And one of the things he said was there's an advantage to going to a Starbucks or going to a co-working space because the conversations around you, instead of being the conversations of all the people who think exactly the way you do and know the stuff you know, is stuff that you wouldn't expect, which in some ways can be the spark of inspiration.
Mm. Okay, fair enough. Let's take some calls. 877-301-8970. Karen Miller is making the case for working at home, and the two of us totally uninformed, Emily Rooney and I, except by our own experiences.
All these people worked at home.
Well,
that's
fine.
And look what they have time for, Jim.
Exactly.
Look
the
what
thing.
They have
Simon
time
and
for.
Alston, you're on with Karen Miller. Thanks so much. Hi, Simon.
Yeah, I know. So I'm working from home today. I work in consulting, so I get to work remote pretty often. And I really enjoy it. Yesterday, I actually went into the office, and I feel like I was much less productive because I haven't been there in a while, and everyone kept coming up to me and saying, hey, how are you? How are you?
What do you do? In the beginning, what do you do?
I do healthcare consulting.
Mm-hmm.
But being in the office, you know, people distract you all the time, and at the same time, you get I have to drive an hour both ways. 2 hours I lose in my day.
Well, that's a big deal.
That's a very good point.
By the way, do you weigh more than you weighed when you started working at home, Simon?
I am snacking a lot, but in the office, we always have pizza, so I feel like maybe I'm losing a little weight home.
Good. Simon, thanks for the call. By the way, that's a really good point. If you live an hour from your office, that is a pretty powerful argument for working at home.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what you see is, you know, that sort of interaction, which in some ways is great at the office and really fun, and that's why, you know, colleagues become friends, also ends up taking away from your workday. I have to say, CEOs, I think, who embrace the idea of working remotely will say, I wanted to hire the best people, and the weird thing was all the best people for my work didn't live within a 30-mile radius of my workplace. You know, crazy, but some
point.
Of them lived in other places, and I wanted to hire them.
Patrick, you're on the road. You're on with Karen Miller on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Patrick.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Excellent.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah, good. Yeah, so, you know, basically, I work from home myself. I'm actually driving home from my day in the office today. You know, I work for a larger audio company here in Massachusetts, and, you know, I work in a call center. So working from home, doing a call center job, when the call comes in, you really don't have a choice but to do your work. So it kind of takes the whole distraction thing out of the picture. The other thing that's really nice about it, I've moved my family to rural New Hampshire, which is about 2.5 hours away from my office, and I only need to come in, you know, once a week. So it's really a benefit.
That's a pretty powerful argument, too. So, Patrick, I don't know if you know yourself well enough for this. If you didn't have a job like you did, but one where you had much more freedom from the phone, would you be able to shy away the distractions, or would you get eaten up by them like I did when I did it?
You know, honestly, I think it works for me because it's such a straightforward job. When that phone rings, you don't have a choice. You got to do your work. Hmm.
Patrick, thanks for the call and enjoy New Hampshire. We appreciate it. Emily, let's go back to the phones.
I've got a couple others here that are working from home. How about Marge in Scituate? Go ahead, Marge.
Hi, Marge.
Hi. Great show. Thank you. I've been working from home for 20 years, and I love it. I work as an artist, a glass artist, a jewelry maker, and I understand the refrigerator thing, too. I got a puppy, and I take him for a walk now. I live in the ocean.
Oh, that's nice.
My life is, it's awesome. I just love it. I don't have to have a store. I sell online.
Oh.
I don't really like people. I'm just kidding.
Well, neither does Jim. That's why he tried it.
I go out in the morning, get my fix of people, and we're so plugged in today. I don't have to be alone ever. Love it, love it, love it.
Boy, you're another great advertisement. Marge, thanks for the call.
Let me say two things I hear. One is like that flexibility of, okay, well, we couldn't maybe afford a really nice house in Boston, but my work is based in Boston, so we moved elsewhere, New Hampshire, and we have a nice house because I don't have to commute every day. But I would say the other thing that we have not heard, the downside, which I have experienced, is that sometimes you work much harder when you work at home because there is no end and beginning to the workday. It's not clear where the barriers are. So you're answering emails at 11 at night and you're answering emails at 7 in the morning and you're answering emails on Sunday. And I actually think it's funny. I think people think when people work at home, they must be, hanging out and watching, I don't know, whatever, stuff during the day. But I think really the danger for motivated people is that you're always going to work and you're going to have a very hard time turning your sort of work face off.
Do they train people? I mean, I'm trying to think again about my own situation, saying I was totally unprepared for this. And, I could have done one extreme, which is become a workaholic at home. I didn't. I chose the opposite extreme where I got nothing done ever except weight gain, as I said. Do these companies train people? If you started in the office and they're trying to convert to more work at home because they think it's more productive, saves them money, whatever, do they train these people in habits that will allow you to make that a success? Because it's not just as easy. You just go do it.
So it is, you're exactly right. It is actually a process of practicing on both ends and slowly starting to work at home, both on the end of the worker, but also on the end of the manager. How do you manage somebody who's not there?
Yeah.
And so you have to learn to use these online tools. You also have to learn to really reserve meetings for the times when you absolutely have to drag somebody away from what they're doing and meet with them physically, because that's how crucial it is. And so meetings become, instead of something you go to four of them every day, they become something that is rare and special, which is probably how they should be.
All right, we're going to take a couple more calls here. We've got Keith, who's on the road. Go ahead, Keith.
Yeah, I've been working from home for about 14 years, and I struggle with all the same things that Jim probably struggled with, but it's an important part of what I do. I do creative work, graphic design, web design, and product development. And the point you just made about the meeting is great, because I'm on my way to a meeting now to meet a client that I've been doing work for years, and I've never met him face-to-face.
Wow.
That is amazing.
Yeah, and he's a great guy, and I know him from talking to him, and I just haven't had the occasion to meet with him face-to-face, and it is an important part of it. It's about, getting away from the office and making sure you're maximizing your time while you're at the office, which is at home, but at the same time, you have to use this kind of strategies that we've been talking about to help you focus, or just to kind of help you put you into that deep zone of thought where you can really get things accomplished.
Now, one thing I'm curious about, we haven't asked any of the other callers, are you married and does your wife work at home too?
No, she does not. She works. She's an educator and she is not in the house. And that is the other distraction that we have to face, is that as 4:30 creeps up, I have to start tapering off work because I have to start thinking about going to get the kids. And that's a challenge too, juggling the schedule of getting kids to where they need to be, putting dinner on the table on the days you need to do that, and anything else. God forbid your car should break down or anything.
Yeah,
like
so
that.
you're the at home person, so you got to do all the domestic chores.
I'm at the desk. I'm in my mobile command center at the moment.
Hey, Keith, do us a favor. I'm intrigued by the notion that you've worked with this person and haven't met him or her. Send us an email after this is over. I'm dying. We'll read it on the show next week. Send us an email. Keith, thanks for the call.
That is such a great call. And it also shows that we are in this era of transitioning from people showing up to work to physically make widgets to people being creative. That is where new jobs are being created. We're already at a point where about 20% of workers work from home. That is just going to increase.
All right. Karen, it's Miller, not going to be us anytime soon. All right. Kara Miller, host of Innovation Hub. You can catch her tonight at 9 and Sunday mornings at 10 right here on 89.7. Thanks for listening to another edition of
Saturday mornings.
And this Saturday.
Why does it say Sunday?
That's okay.
It's a typo.
This Saturday.
I always hear it too.
Tom Friedman.
I love Tom Friedman.
Yeah.
All
right. And tomorrow for our news quiz, it's going to be fun. Former city councilors, mayoral candidates Mike Ross and John Connolly are going to be facing off over the week's
headlines.
That's
great.
Going to be a blast.
Now, you're Emily Rooney, correct?
I'm Emily Rooney. You're Jim Browdy.
That is correct. Marjorie Egan is off till Monday. Emily will be back tomorrow. So will I. Maybe I'll do it from home. I'm not sure.
Exactly. Call in on that ISDN.
Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow at noon.